With our analysis of this sugya of Pocheach, trying to replicate the research and an analytic process of arriving at a halakhic conclusion from the words of the Torah, of Tanakh, and of the Gemara. And yesterday we surveyed the opinion of the Rif. The Rif said that a Pocheach means a person whose arms and shoulders are bare. And we noted that there were a number of anomalies in the Rif. Number one, where we might have expected him to appeal to the Maseches Sofrim, which defines a Pocheach as one whose clothes are torn, the Rif does not appeal to the Maseches Sofrim. Second anomaly is that the Rif seems to define Pocheach as one whose clothes are torn, as well as one whose arms and shoulders are bare. Those were two anomalies that we noted in the Rif. But neither of these were such troublesome anomalies. It could be that the Maseches Sofrim was not available to the Rif. It could be that he felt that he didn't want to appeal to it because the Maseches Sofrim offered a second definition, namely one whose knees are visible, and he didn't want to quote the source that only was mixed in terms of the amount that it supported him. And in terms of the second anomaly, why does he give these two different definitions? The consensus was that both definitions were really one and the same, that a person whose sleeves are ripped off, that's basically a person whose shoulders and arms are bare. And so the Rif was simply explaining, when he says whose clothes are torn, he was explaining that he meant a person whose clothes were torn in such a way as to reveal the shoulders and the arms. And we concluded yesterday's shiur by noting that whenever one is reading through the Rif, so one also turns his attention to the commentary on the side of the Rif, a student of a student of a student of the Ramban. For those who were dissatisfied with the fact that the printers of the Talmud Bavli left the Ramban off the side of the page of Gemara, at least they included somebody from his Beis Medrash on the side of the page of the Rif. And the Ran, we said, had two commentaries. One, a commentary on the Gemara. The second, the commentary on Halacha. The Halachic commentary was structured as a commentary on the Rif. And so we turn our attention now to source number 10 on page 3, which is the commentary of the Ran on the paragraph of the Rif that we read yesterday. The Ran began by quoting Rashi in order to sort of just round out the range of opinions. The Rif did not quote Rashi. He did not quote any Rishon who gave Rashi's interpretation of what a Pocheach is. So the Ran, in order to expand our horizons, to give us a sense of the breadth of the opinions of the Rishonim, quoted Rashi. He quoted... The Rif was before Rashi. Yeah, but did Rashi make it up, or did Rashi get it from earlier sources? Maybe, not really clear, but he quotes Rashi. He quotes Rashi's proof from the Targum, but he says that that doesn't seem to work, and he's about to explain why. Says the Ran, and this is a little bit of a complicated proof. He says, we learned that a Pocheach may not be the Shliach Tzibor for Shmona Esrei. But later, we learn that one who refuses to be a Shliach Tzibor because he's wearing sandals may not be a Shliach Tzibor even if later on he's willing to be a Shliach Tzibor barefoot. So this Mishnah that the Ran is quoting is in source number 11. Just take a look, right? Because it's always worthwhile. Sometimes people can spend an hour on a line of a Rishon because they don't look up the source, and so they're trying to figure out what does this line mean. Sometimes all it takes is opening up to the source that the Rishon is quoting, and that immediately dispels difficulties with what the Rishon means and what he's trying to do. So let's just quickly turn to source number 11, which the Ran is quoting. The Mishnah says, HaOmer, Eini Over Lefnei Ateva Bitzvuin, person who says, I'm not going to go daven for the Amor because I'm wearing a colored shirt. Af bilavanim lo yavar, he's not even allowed to daven for the Amud in white clothing if he changes his mind later on and says, ah, no, I don't care, it's okay, I'm wearing a... No, he can't daven for the Amud no matter what color clothing is. If he refuses to daven for the Amud because of the color of his clothing, he is barred from serving as a Shliach Tzibor. The Gemara over there explains that that's because we suspect him of being a member of the Minim, a sect of Jews who did not practice halacha, did not share the beliefs of the mainstream of the Jewish people. I can give you a name of what the sect was as well, if you like. And therefore, because he doesn't share the same beliefs as the Jewish people, he's not qualified to serve as a shliach tzibur. And the same is true, one who refuses to be a shliach tzibur in sandals, even if later on he's willing to daven barefoot, he still is not allowed to go, because only people who belong to this sect would consider the lack of shoes to be a an impediment to serving as a shliach tzibur, and therefore the fact that he was unwilling to daven in his sandals unless he was wearing shoes indicates that he subscribes to the beliefs of this sect and therefore is not suitable for being a shliach tzibur.
Shouldn't be the opposite? If he doesn't want to daven with a sandal, with a sandal, then even if he has shoes, he shouldn't daven. He's going to be barefoot.
But here we say that even if later on he tries to disavow what he said earlier, so not only will I daven in sandals, I'll even daven barefoot if you want me to. So he's trying to disavow. He's saying, oh no, I don't belong to that sect. You suspect me of belonging to them. I'd daven for the Amud even barefoot. They would never daven barefoot. They wouldn't even daven in sandals. Kol shekin that they wouldn't daven barefoot. So he's trying to disavow any association that he may have with that sect. But we assume that he refused because he belonged to the sect, and only after when he saw that we're beginning to suspect him, so he's trying to dispel the suspicion.
But what does one have to do with the other? What if he doesn't want to wear a colored clothes? It has to do with being a sect of another? I don't understand what's in
it. It was a cultural practice that there was a certain group of people. They're still around nowadays, although they don't necessarily have this practice. And in the olden days, so they used to say, I'm not going to daven for the Amud unless I'm wearing all white, and I'm not going to daven for the Amud unless I'm wearing shoes. So if a person says, I'm not going to daven for the Amud unless I'm wearing all white and unless I'm wearing shoes, we suspect that he belongs to that sect. Then later on, he tries to disavow it, to disassociate himself. Daven in purple clothing and barefoot. So we assume that he's only doing that to dispel the suspicion. He's not doing that really to, because he doesn't belong to that sect. He's doing it because he realizes that we're on to him, and he's trying to go undercover. So he's.
What is that sect called,
Rabbi?
Hamavin Yavin. Hamavin Yavin.
If you don't have a jacket in the head, then I'm going to let you down.
This is the one that's known as Hates.
I remember I once davened in a place which had a sign that if you have a chup, you can't daven for the Amud.
But that's this aloch, that's something based on aloch, but that's good. But the colored shirt or sandals, you wouldn't let you
chup. In this country?
You know it. You know what it is?
Chup.
Yeah, like Trump.
He's called a chup.
No.
Like a
duck hair.
Not a duck hair.
Those were the days, I'm sure.
Remember, I'm rich.
When we had some hair.
Rich in name only.
No.
We had a piece of day.
Okay,
so basically there is no inherent problem with a person refusing to daven for the Amud in colored clothing or in sandals. The problem is that members of that particular sect who were infiltrating the mainstream Jewish faith, they used to have this practice. And so this used to be one of the ways that you can tell whether a person was an infiltrator or whether a person was for real. And therefore, the problem is not that he refused to daven in colored clothing. The problem was that he belonged to this particular deviant sect which had deviant beliefs which disqualified its members from serving as shluchi tzibur. People daven to God, right, are not able to have an agent as someone who believes in an avodah zarah and who worships an avodah zarah.
Point out that nowadays that all clothing is colored. Like even a white shirt is colored. And a white shirt is old and color starts to fade, it's no longer white. It's some kind of gray, some kind of, light brown or something. It's like all colors nowadays are not natural colors. They're all colors.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah, I suspect that it had to do with the symbolism of white, because white symbolizes purity and white symbolizes cleanliness. And so, in terms of Hilchos Nida, so sometimes you'll have something which is an off-white, right? But for Hilchos Nida purposes, we'll still consider it to be white. There's a difference between blood that's found on a white garment and blood that's found on a colored garment. And there, the definition of white is a very expansive definition. It's not a narrow definition. I know somebody who one time bought an off-white off-white clothing, and they thought that it was just off-white, and so it wasn't a problem, and that ended up causing difficulties because off-white is considered to be white as well for those purposes. For tzaras, maybe off-white is not considered to be white, but for tzaras, the Gemara says there are 98 different shades of white. So on the one hand, you know, the Gemara acknowledges that all 98 of them are described as white, even though there are these different 98 different shades. So some of them may qualify as tzaras, some of them may not, but it's not because they're not white. It's because they're not white enough to be considered tzaras. So bracketing for a moment a discussion about the propriety of restricting people from being a shliach tzibur unless they're wearing certain clothing, the Ran wants to make the following inference from this Mishnah. It seems that this person is willing to daven for the Amud even barefoot. He says, I'm not willing to daven unless I'm wearing shoes. And then to show that he doesn't belong to this sect, whether it's an honest display or whether it's a dishonest display, in order to disassociate himself, he says, I'm willing to daven even barefoot. So the Mishnah seems to indicate that if not for the fact that we suspect him, based on his previous declaration of belonging to this sect of people who serve Avodah Zarah, we would permit him to daven for the Amud barefoot. And if not for the fact that we suspect him, based on his earlier assertion, we would allow him to daven for the Amud barefoot. That's what he's trying to do. He's trying to convince us that he really is from, he really believes in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's why he's willing to daven for the Amud barefoot. If not for the fact that we suspected him originally, we would permit him to daven barefoot. So how can it be, says the Ran, that Pucheach means a person who's barefoot, if it's clear that someone who's barefoot is allowed to daven for the Amud? Says Iran, this implies that someone else who did not refuse to repeat Shmoneh Esrei in sandals may repeat it barefoot. This is very similar to the proof that the Bach brought, that Pocheach can't do Birkas Kohanim, and obviously everyone does Birkas Kohanim barefoot, so therefore Pocheach cannot mean person who's barefoot.
If Pocheach is barefoot, what's Yechef?
Pocheach. That's what Rashi said from the Targum. The Targum said that the translation of Yechef is Picheach. So that's what everyone's fighting against. The Bach is fighting against that. The Ran is fighting against that. Rashi quoted the Targum, who says that Yachif is Picheach. So rather, says the Ran, Picheach means one whose clothes are torn and whose skin is visible in many places, as Rabbi Alfasi explained. Okay, that's a little bit different than what the Rif said. The Rif said whose arms and shoulders are bare. The Ran quotes the Rif, or paraphrases the Rif as saying, whose skin is visible in many places. And he quotes the other proof, the translation of naked and barefoot is pocheach and yachif. So naked is pocheach is naked, it means whose skin is visible. Such a person, he says, may recite the half shema, since they didn't stand in front of the ark or table for the half shema. In other words, when a person comes late to shul, as we described, and he gets up and he says, Melech Yachin, so he didn't do that from the Bima, he didn't do that from the Amud, he would do that from wherever he was davening. And therefore, it's less of a violation, it's less of an affront to the public dignity. This person is not standing up in the middle of shul where the person who represents the tzibur stands. He's doing it for himself from his own seat, and therefore it's not such an affront to the tzibur. Since they didn't stand in front of the ark or table for half shema, and he may translate the Torah reading, since this does not involve too much importance, it wasn't a position of great chashivos in the times of the Gemara. Since the greater person reads the Torah, the Baal Kriya is the biggest baki, and the lesser person translates. But he may not be a shliach tzibur for Shmoneh Esrei or say Birkas Kohanim, since this is not proper kavod hatzibur. So again, the Ran is just elaborating for us. He has an implied kasha. The Gemara says that Pocheach can't be a shliach tzibur because of kavod hatzibur. So why can he be a mitargim? Why is that not a violation of kavod hatzibur? So to that he says, well, it's only a violation of kavod hatzibur if a person is taking a position of importance and is not dressing the part. But if a person is taking a position which doesn't call for such an important character to take it, so then if he's not dressed the part of an important character, it's not a violation of kavod hatzibur. If a person is not doing something to represent or on behalf of the public. He's doing it for himself, from his own personal seat, and not in the place where the Shliach Tzibur stands. It's not a violation of Kavodat Tzibur for him to be dressed improperly.
A Kohen who duchens without shoe, without socks, is he allowed to, or does he have socks?
Yeah. Nowadays, maybe, because everyone duchens with socks. We wouldn't want him to duchen without socks, so he shouldn't distract people. I don't think it's a problem. I don't think it's a problem. Yeah. In general, a Kohen shouldn't do something which is incredibly unusual because it might distract people. So if everyone, you know, for the last 100 years in this community duchened in sacks and he's going to duchen barefoot, so it may distract people. So it would not be advisable.
When Hashem said to Moshe, Shana Alecha Maraglecha, Moshe have socks?
Probably not. Probably not. There's a big discussion about wearing socks on Yom Kippur and wearing socks on Tisha B'Av, that the Vilna Gaon maybe thinks that socks are not appropriate. A person should literally be barefoot, and that's a whole discussion unto itself. But most people think that as long as it's not leather, but there are some Yishonim who say that no, the point is to be a little bit more uncomfortable, and if you have shoes that are not leather but are just as comfortable as leather shoes, so then perhaps they should not be worn. So what the Ran granted us, the significant contribution that the Ran made over here, is not so much in his analysis of the Rif and his analysis of Rashi. Pretty much the proofs that the Ran brought and explanations that the Ran brought simply round out explanations that we've already seen. But what is vastly significant is the Ran's paraphrase of both Rashi and of the Rif. Because up until now, we've been interpreting Rashi in accordance with the Bach, that the main interpretation that Rashi is committed to is the interpretation of bare knees, while the Ran seems to understand Rashi as saying bare feet. And similarly, the Rif, up until now, we've been understanding that he said bare shoulders and arms, and the Ran possibly expands that and possibly reinterprets it as meaning someone whose skin is visible in many places. So we have to keep that in mind. There's our reading of the Rif, there's the Ran's reading of the Rif. Usually the Ran's reading of the Rif is more authoritative than our reading of the Rif. And so we may need to abandon our narrower reading of the Rif in favor of the Ran's more expansive reading of the Rif, unless we find further evidence that supports the way that we were reading the Rif to begin with. Now there's another question that we have to confront as well, and that is, what happens if there's some circumstance where our reading of the Rif would lead to a Chumrah, and the Ran's reading of the Rif would lead to a Kula? So then, whose reading would we follow? Would we follow the Ran's reading, even though it leads to a leniency? Or would we follow our reading, because Safek Lahachmir? Is our reading of the Rif sufficient to create a Safek, which would demand, which would require us to be a little bit Mahmir? What's a case, by the way? What would be a case where the Ran leads to a leniency, and our reading of the Rif leads to a stringency?
Have you compared yourself to the Ran?
This is part of the process. The part of the process is that we have to analyze every single text as we see it, and then compare our analysis with the analysis of the Rishonim, and then weigh, right, what are the advantages of our analysis, what are the advantages of the Rishonim's analysis. If we consistently come up that our analysis is better than the Rishonim's analysis, perhaps we ought to ask somebody, or we have what to analyze it once again. But in the end of the day, this is what Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in his introduction to the Igros Moshe. He says, in the end of the day, Ein l'chacham ela mashe einav ro'os. He says, just like I will sometimes argue on Rabbi Akiva Eger, even though I know that Rabbi Akiva Eger is much greater than myself, and hence, when I'm comparing my interpretations with Rabbi Akiva Eger's interpretations, I make every effort to defend and to justify and to understand and to internalize the reasoning of Rabbi Akiva Eger. But if after I've made every single effort to do that, which is what is required by Rabbi Akiva Eger's great stature, if after I've made every single effort to do that, I still find myself unconvinced by Rabbi Akiva Eiger's reasoning. So then, as a responsible person, I can't rely on a reasoning which I'm not convinced by. I can't rely on a reasoning which I don't understand. I can't rely on a reasoning which does not seem to be consistent with the way that that I understand the Gemara, and therefore I will have to paskin against Rabbi Akiva Eiger. That's what Rabbi Moshe says is his duty as a posek. And then Rabbi Moshe goes on and says, "Dear reader, I beg of you, don't treat me any differently than I treat Rabbi Akiva Eiger. I don't deserve it. Nobody deserves it," he says. "If you certainly," this is, Rabbi Moshe doesn't write this, but it goes without saying, "you should treat me with a lot of respect, and you should do your best to try to understand, you know, what I'm writing and my line of reasoning, and go over and over and over again to try to understand it. But that doesn't mean that as soon as you read it in Igros Moshe, you should abandon all of your other assumptions and all of your other understandings and just grab onto mine, whether you understand it or not, and whether you think it's consistent with the proper interpretation or not." Says, "Give me the benefit of the doubt, but if in the end of the day you don't understand it, I beg of you, ein lechacham ela mash ein avros. You have to paskin based on the way that you see the sugya." So I'm not saying that our reading is the same level of authority as the Ran. I'm not saying that our reading is likely to be as accurate as reading of the Ran. But what I am saying is that when one is pursuing this line of research, a person cannot abandon their understanding of something simply because they saw an alternate understanding in one of the Rishonim. A person has to be able to entertain multiple possibilities. A person has to be able to label each possibility with the weight that it deserves. The Ran certainly gets a heavier weight than our reading does, but we need to be able to entertain in our minds all of the different possibilities, all of the possibilities to understand at once how much each what the likelihood is of each possibility being correct, and only when the sugya is done can we really assess everything altogether and come to a final conclusion about to what extent is our reading unreliable and to what extent perhaps are we allowed to rely on it. So let me tell you some stories about Rav Moshe. I heard this story from Rabbi Tendler, who said it over in the name of Rav Gustman. He said that one time Rav Gustman's wife was in a hospital in New York City for treatment. This was already after Rav Gustman had moved to Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Moshe called up Rabbi Tendler and he said, "Please, can you be Mevaker Chole by Rav Gustman? He's a tremendous person, and can you be Mevaker Chole every week? Go visit him and his wife." And so Rabbi Tendler used to visit them and they would talk. And one time Rav Gustman said to him, "Did you ever hear the story that made Rav Moshe's reputation in Europe? Where was it that Europe first became aware of Rav Moshe's stature?" He hadn't heard. So Rav Gustman said, "I'll tell you what happened. There was a woman who had a certain operation that in her ear that caused there to be a hole in her skull. And it was dangerous for her to get water into her ear because that could go into between the skull and the brain and can cause all sorts of complications. And the question was whether she could go to the mikvah, or whether, because if she goes to the mikvah, she's got to be fully immersed, which would put water into her ear. So that was definitely a no-no medically. So the question was, could she stuff her ear with katan and still go to the mikvah, or is the katan a chatzitza?" There are a number of tshuvos, and Rav Moshe published in Igros Moshe the tshuvos which he addressed on the subject. So originally, when this shaila became known to the poskim in Europe, Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky penned a long tshuva where he opined that there was no way that this woman could go to the mikvah, that the katan in the ear constituted a chatzitza. When Rav Moshe got a copy of Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky's tshuva, he learned the sugya as well, and he came to the opposite conclusion that the katan does not constitute a chatzitza. And he wrote a response also saying that she's allowed to go to the mikvah, that the katan is not a chatzitza. And both of the responses, Rabbi Yecheskel Abramsky's and Rav Moshe Feinstein's, arrived at the desk of Rabbi Chaim Ozer. And Rabbi Chaim Ozer said that while originally he was convinced by the reasoning of Rabbi Yecheskel, but when he read through Rav Moshe's tshuva, he felt that you couldn't argue on it. And the reason you couldn't argue on it, he said, is because Rav Moshe writes like a Rishon. What does it mean that Rav Moshe writes like a Rishon? So he explained. He said, Rav Moshe, everything that he says is based on the Gemara. That every single proof is from the Gemara. It's not that he's quoting somebody the generation before him or the generation before that. Every single thing that he says is based on the Gemara. That's what characterizes in Rav Chaim Ozer's mind the writing of a Rishon. That everything is really built up from the building blocks of the Gemara, which are the ultimate building blocks of everything. He said, so a posik who writes like a Rishon, you can't argue on him, even if you're a Rabbi Chezkel Abramsky. At the time, Rav Moshe was very young, and he carried the day. Rav Chaim Ozer gave him the, you know, gave him his haskama.
That means a musician.
Yeah. So I'll tell you another story about Rav Moshe. My brother-in-law told me this story. He said that he heard it from Rav Kalman Epstein. So the story goes that I think Rav Moshe had a certain interpretation of a Rambam. And it was very, very difficult reading to fit into the words of the Rambam. It was very difficult to fit it into the words of the Rambam. So Rav Kalman, I think, one time encountered Rav Moshe at a wedding. And he said to him, my apologies if I'm repeating this wrong, but I'm already third hand. But he said to him, he said, what's pshat in your reading of this Rambam? So Rav Moshe said to him, he said, you know, this is what the Gemara says. If you read the Gemara, it's clear that this is what the Gemara says. It's impossible that the Rambam is passing against the Gemara. So if this is what the Gemara means, it must be what the Rambam means. The words of the Rambam don't seem to support that, but the Rambam's not going to go against the Gemara. That's what the Gemara means, so that must be what the Rambam means. So everything is based on the Gemara. And there's a third story I have to look up in the biography of Rav Shach. So they have a couple of paragraphs about Rav Moshe, because Rav Moshe learned, I think, in Slutsk for a little while Rav Shach was there as well. And there's a very similar story there about Rav Moshe that I think what they said was is that all the Bacharim in Slutsk knew that even though most poskim did not have the ability to paskin from the Gemara, but they all knew that Rav Moshe was unique in the sense that he was able to arrive at a psak halacha just from the Gemara upwards. So this may be something that made Rav Moshe unique, maybe something which other people should strive to emulate. But so now the question is, you know, can you go against a Rishon? Very, very complicated question. You have to go into a whole bunch of history for this. So I apologize, we're going on a little bit of a tangent, but you have to go into a little bit of history for this. We know that there's a principle that the Amoraim cannot or do not argue on the Tanoim. That is true, but that's not necessarily a halachic declaration. That's an agadic declaration which dictates how we should think of ourselves vis-a-vis those who came before us. Because in lechacham ela masha in of roos. We also have a principle that says b'makom chilul Hashem in cholkim kavod l'rav. That if a person sees that his rabbi seems to be giving a wrong psak, which is going to lead to a person doing an avera, so under some circumstances he has an obligation to, before that person does the avera, at least if it's an isra d'oraisa, to stop the person from doing it. His Rebbe just gave a psak. If it's an Isser D'Oraisa, he's got to jump ahead and say, wait, don't do it. I have a kasha. If it's an Isser D'Rabbanan, so then you wait until afterwards, at least under some circumstances. If it's an Isser D'Oraisa, ein chalkin kavod l'rav. Malkum chilul Hashem, ein chalkin kavod l'rav. So we have such ideas that a person, when it comes to psak halacha, he's got to make sure that the people don't do averos. If that means that he's going against his rebbeim, if it means that he's going against the rishonim, so there are ample grounds for justifying even being at least being machmir against the rishonim. But so let's just think for a second. There are two basic opinions about why it is that the amoraim do not argue on the tanaim. There's one opinion, I forget who says what. There's one opinion that says that the reason is because the Amoraim all got together and they agreed by consensus not to argue on the Tanaim. In other words, there is nothing that actually prevents or impedes the Amoraim from arguing on the Tanaim, but there was simply a consensus that at this point the canon of Tanaim is sealed for whatever reason, and we're not going to argue on whatever went before us. When we say Rav, Tana, Hu, Upalig, it might mean that Rav simply did not join the consensus and therefore he was not bound to by this stricture against arguing on the Tanaim, or it might mean that at the consensus that they said, you know, Rav is an exception. One way or another, it's not something which is built into the framework of halacha that the Amoraim can't argue on the Tanaim. According to this opinion, I think it's a Kesef Mishnah's opinion that it was simply something that the Amoraim accepted upon themselves. The second opinion, I believe, is attributed to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, or maybe it came from the Rav. I forget who originated it. And the second opinion says that in order to argue on somebody, a person must be in the same category as they are. Right? You're not going to have a minor league team playing against a major league team. You're not going to get that. At least
the same level. The same level, the same league.
Right. So there was a certain shlimus hayidia, a completion of knowledge that the Tanaim had, which the Amoraim lacked. That the Mesorah was fragmented a little bit more, a little bit too much in the times of the Amoraim, and therefore the Amoraim understood that there's a halachic principle that if I am lacking certain parts of the Mesorah, I can't argue on a person who possessed those parts of the Mesorah. And so therefore it literally was built in, to the system that that the Amoraim cannot argue on the Tanaim. Now, why can't we argue on the Amoraim? Why can't the Rishonim argue on the Amoraim? Why can't the Geonim argue on the Amoraim? So here I think there's a machlokes between Reb Elchanan and the Chazon Ish. You'll pardon me because I think I only remember Reb Elchanan's position. I don't remember the Chazon Ish's position. I have to look it up again. But Reb Elchanan says that the reason is because whenever the majority, or perhaps the entirety, of the Chachamim agree to a particular position, it acquires the status of a psak of the Sanhedrin HaGadol. And once something has the status of the psak of the Sanhedrin HaGadol, only a different Sanhedrin, which is greater than the original Sanhedrin in Chachma and in Minyan, is allowed to argue on it. The Talmud Bavli was ratified by most or all of the Chachmei Yisrael. Therefore, all of the halakos and the minhagim which are contained in the Talmud Bavli have the status of a ruling of the Sanhedrin HaGadol. And in order to undo that, you would need a consensus of all of the Chachamim, or most of the Chachamim of Klal Yisrael. And not just that, but though the Chachamim who have this consensus to argue on the Gemara would have to be greater in Chachma and in Minyan than the Amoraim. And that certainly you're not going to get nowadays, probably not until Mashiach comes, and maybe not even after that. So this is very, very similar to what Reb Chaim was saying, namely that there's a certain shleimus hachachma that the Tanoim had that the Amoraim did not have, and therefore, if you assume that the Mishnah was canonized by the vote, by the consensus of most of the Chachamim of that time, then since the Amoraim lost, they didn't have, there's no way that they can regain the same level of hachma as the Tanoim, therefore they're not able to repeal or to supersede the psak of the Tanaim. So we tend to assume, I think, that our Mesorah is more fragmented, that there are more pieces missing than there were in the times of the Amoraim. And therefore, again, says Reb Elchanan, there's no way that we will be able to constitute a Beis Din which is Gadol B'Chachma from the Beis Din of the Amoraim. So even if you got the consensus of most or all of the poskim of a particular generation in the diaspora, that still will be insufficient to supersede what's written in the Gemara, because we'll never fulfill that condition of Gadlos B'Chachma. So now the question becomes, what about the Rishonim and the Achronim?
But the second reason is contradicting the first reason. Thank you very much. The question is, you said that Amoraim got together and decided not to... The first reason is, you said that Amoraim got together and they decided not to argue on Tanoim. But if that thing is true, then...
It's a machlokas, the Kesef Mishnah and Reb Chaim. The Kesef Mishnah says, right, says that it's because of a consensus that he just decided not to. Reb Chaim says that they're not allowed to, that it's built into the process. Right. So the question is, number one, right, was there ever a consensus? Was there ever a consensus amongst the Chachamim of a given generation not to argue on the words of the Rishonim. Was there ever such a consensus that all the Chachamim of a generation either got together or they all independently arrived at this conclusion that we're not going to argue on the words of the Rishonim? So one way to do this is to go through the Sifrei HaPoskim from each generation and see whether the Poskim argue on the Rishonim or not. In general, the answer is they don't. So that might indicate, that might indeed indicate that that there was such a consensus. If you go through the Sfarim for 300 years and you discover that instances where Achronim of note argue on Rishonim are virtually non-existent, so that would seem to indicate that there was a general consensus not to argue on the Rishonim.
Rishonim argue among themselves, so then the Achronim say, okay, I go regard to this Rishon, and I go regard to that Rishon.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a famous thing with the Sefer Ilfei Menashe. I have to look up. There was a famous story. I think that the Talmidei HaGra maybe had a slightly different perspective on this. So that seems to be that there is such a consensus, an unstated consensus, but not having gone through this systematically, I'm only saying this as a general impression rather than as a conclusion that I've drawn after performing all the research. What about the second opinion? What about the Shlemos HaMesora opinion? So can
the point that he said, that can you pick and choose? Like if you show them argue, you don't argue on them, but you can pick and run as a I pick one. Can I pick two? I understand this word. Is that arguing a second one?
It depends if you're a brisker.
can I postulate my own theory on this?
Well, we're trying to go through the process, and we're trying to elaborate a little bit on to what extent a person can rely on their own reading, and to what extent not. In general, we emphasize that we have to give a tremendous benefit of the doubt to the reading of the Rishonim, and to a certain extent, we have to approach the whole sugya with an amount of humility, so that if it seems that there's a gap somewhere in our knowledge that might be relevant to the question at hand, so then certainly if there's a concern that there's a gap in our knowledge, right, that might be relevant to the question, then we certainly cannot rely on our own opinion. But if we've gone through the research and we've done a thorough research so that there are no gaps in our knowledge, and we've tried and tried again and tried again and tried again to convince ourselves of the reading that the particular Rishon has, and we were unable to convince ourselves of it, and let's say that there's a different Rishon, maybe a less authoritative Rishon or fewer Rishonim, that may make a difference also, but somebody else who says like us, so then I would say that usually, again, the research is thorough, and we've approached the sugya with all of the humility necessary, right? And our own reading, even though it's not consistent with the reading of the most authoritative Rishonim, it's consistent with some Rishonim, so under those circumstances, I would say that it's usually safe to rely on one's own reading. But if one of the three is absent, if there's a gap in the research, or if we're not yet experienced enough to know whether or not there's a gap in the research, if the sugya was not approached with the proper humility, giving the Rishonim the benefit of the doubt and trying again and again to understand and to grasp their line of reasoning, right? Or if it's incredibly suspicious that there are no Rishonim who read as we read, which is usually something which should raise a red flag, so under those circumstances I would say that usually it's not so safe to rely on one's own reading, even if one's own reading generates a chumrah. And certainly if it generates a kula, correct. But right now, let's just come back down to earth. So we're still in the middle of the research process. And in the middle of the research process, we can't simply abandon our own reading of a Rishon or our own reading of a Gemara just because we found in a Sefer a different reading. We have to be able to keep both readings in our mind, to give both of them a certain initial estimate of how much they weigh, and to be able to alter that estimate based on further evidence that we will encounter. So it's just worth keeping in mind that the Ran read Rashi as saying barefoot, the Bach read Rashi as saying bare need, the Ran read the Rif as saying clothing torn in many places and skin visible, but we read the Rif in a more literal sense, saying bare arms and bare shoulders. And we have to keep all of those interpretations in mind, both of the Gemara and of the Rishonim, as we go further and see which ones are borne out by the evidence. Okay. So, having seen the Rif, which is one third of the triumvirate upon which the Beis Yosef bases his psak, we have to proceed now to see the next of the three, which is the Rosh. The Rif and the Rosh are both in the back of the Gemara, and so therefore they will usually be more accessible to someone who's reading the Gemara than the Rambam, and so I'm not putting it in order of importance, chas v'chalila, that I should be rating these Rishonim in terms of importance, but in terms of convenience at least, the Rif and the Rosh are more conveniently located usually than the Rambam is. So the Rosh usually is coming on the footsteps of Tosfos, and so I put Tosfos here before the Rosh, just so that we can see the commentary of the Gemara, and then how that evolves into a halachic decision. So Tosfos in source number 12 say, Rashi explained that naked and barefoot is translated artilai and pachi. Had a slightly different translation, he dropped the last ches, and that's how he's characterizing Rashi. He's characterizing Rashi by the Targum, like the Ran, and not by the Maseches Sofrim, like the Bach. Then
also the Vav he missed.
And he's also missing the Vav. Oh. Yeah. This is not so, says Tosfos. Pachi is the translation of naked, not the translation of barefoot. Rabbi Alfas also explained that Pachi is one who wears torn clothes, and this is also implied by the first chapter of Kiddushin. Well, the Achronim on the side say that they're not really sure where in the first chapter of Kiddushin this is implied. That seems to be a mystery. Maybe it's a typo in Tosfos. It's very, very rare that Tosfos quotes the Rif. This is one of the very few instances where Tosfos does that. What can we derive from Tosfos? Number one, that Tosfos is adding his weight to the opinion of the Rif. Number two, Tosfos only quotes the first half of the Rif, not the second half. He quotes the torn clothes part, which is consistent with the Maseches Sofrim and with the Yerushalmi, but he doesn't go with that more exact and more precise description that the Rif offered, namely of bare arms and bare shoulders. Right? The Ran also seemed to shy away from the bare arm, bare shoulders part of the Rif, and seemed to go more with simply the torn clothes part of the Rif. When we read the Rif, we were much more impressed with the bare arms, bare shoulders. But neither the Ran nor Tosfos seems to have seen that particular description as being the main characteristic of the Rif's interpretation. So with that, we can turn to the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher. The Rosh was probably the second to last generation of Balei HaTosfos. We know that the Balei HaTosfos stretched from the generation of, if you want, call it the generation of Rashi, if you want, call it the generation of Rabbeinu Tam. And then from there, the Ri was Rabbeinu Tam's nephew, and there were a couple of generations, and the Rosh was really the second to last generation of the Balei HaTosfos. In the times of the Rosh, as we mentioned earlier, the persecution against the Jews and against Torah scholars in particular had come to a crescendo in Germany, to the point when Torah scholars were fleeing Germany en masse. The Marami Rotenberg, right, when he was imprisoned, so I heard from some historians that he wasn't just Stam imprisoned. He was imprisoned because he was fleeing Germany for Spain, where because the Spanish kingdom at that time was still busy fighting outwards, expanding its borders, and in conflict with the various Muslim kingdoms that were on its borders, they had less energy to devote to persecuting the Jews that were in their midst. And therefore, Spain at the time was much more hospitable to the Jews than Ashkenaz was. Ashkenaz, the Christian, the Catholic kingdom of Ashkenaz, of Germany and of France, had so consolidated its power, it did not have enemies on its frontiers, and therefore it was turning more and more its energies to persecuting the Jews and attempting to convert them. And so as it became less and less hospitable to the Jews, more and more Jews sought to flee from Germany and France and to find a more an easier place to live and to practice their Judaism in Spain. And so the Maharam of Rothenburg was caught at the border. It was against the law for Jews to leave because they didn't want the Jews to keep on practicing Judaism, and so they wanted to keep them in a place where they'd be able to prevent them from practicing. So the Maharam was arrested at the border and imprisoned, as we said, for many, many years because he refused to be ransomed. But Baruch Hashem, his student, the Rosh, succeeded in fleeing. But basically, this exodus represented the end of the Tosafist tradition, because following that, basically all of the Gedolim were in Sfarad, and therefore their methodology and their approach and their tradition was already a little bit different. It was influenced to a much greater extent by the thinking of the Sephardi Rishonim, who themselves were students of the Baalei HaTosfos, as the Ramban writes in his introduction to the Kunshus Dina de Garmi, but who nonetheless had much greater fealty to the methodology and the conclusions of the Rif and of the Rambam than the Ashkenazic and French Baalei HaTosfos did. So the Rosh was basically the second to last generation of the Baalei HaTosfos. There was one more generation of Gedolim which either didn't or couldn't flee from Germany. Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz, I think, was the last generation of the Baalei HaTosfos, and after Rabbeinu Peretz, the Tosafist school deteriorated into something that more closely resembles the writings of later Achronim, and therefore should not necessarily be classified as Tosafist thinking. So
later Achronim?
It's a very
early,
meaning the style of the Baalei HaTosfos was characterized by a certain balance between commenting on the Gemara, explaining the simple pshat, and the Tosafists do certain things. The Achronim who followed Rabbeinu Peretz, they spent the lion's share of their time just analyzing every word of Tosfos.
There was Achronim are current generation.
Achronim are from the 16th or 17th century, right, up until possibly all the way up until our generation. But in different countries, so the shift in style and of methodology occurred earlier, and in different countries it occurred later. So one might say that those who wrote in Germany, and again, there was a certain resurgence, and figures like the Marival and who else, the Trumas Hadeshen and others arose in Germany after these persecutions, who are still considered by the Beis Yosef and by others to be Rishonim, but those figures are not noted so much for their commentaries on the Gemara as they are for their halachic responsa. And so there definitely was a shift between the times of Rabbeinu Peretz and the times when figures of stature once again arose in Ashkenaz and in Tsarfas, and that shift was, right, you can see it by the different genres which were pursued by those Rishonim, by those Gedolim who arose in those countries after this this persecution reached its peak and then began to subside a little bit. So that's another difficulty, just addressing the question that you mentioned earlier with talking about we can't argue on the Rishonim. One of the great difficulties is determining when the period of the Rishonim ended and when the period of the Achronim began. So that's another difficulty. So all of that was simply by way of introduction to the writing of the Rosh. The Rosh, because he was one of the last of the Baalei HaTosfos, he was in a unique position to analyze, to synthesize, to digest all of the writings of the Baalei HaTosfos that preceded him, and to come out with the best, the most relevant, etc. And so therefore his halachic code is considered to be the authoritative halachic code which embodies the interpretations, the rulings, and the traditions of the Baalei HaTosfos.
Is considered a Rishon? I never heard of not a Rishon, but he was in the statue of 1400.
Yeah. I think that Reb Ben Sion Abba Shaul has a nice essay about that. I don't remember exactly what his conclusion is, but he talks about where the Ari HaKadosh stands in terms of the stature that's accorded to different poskim. So, I think it's in the introduction to one of the volumes of his tshuvos. It's not the first volume, but one of the later volumes of his tshuvos. So he has an essay about this. So one could imagine that if the persecution in Ashkenaz had not intensified precisely when it did, that one might have imagined that the Baal HaTosfos would have continued doing what they did, and then maybe some later code would have superseded the code of the Rosh. But the fact is that because the persecution brought the age of the Baal HaTosfos to an end, the Rosh is really the culmination of the tradition of the Baal HaTosfos. So let's quickly see a little bit of the Rosh. We'll be able to read through it quickly because the Rosh is basically going to spend a lot of his time telling us, reviewing with us, things that we've already seen either in the Rif or in Tosfos. Says the Rosh, Pocheach means one whose clothes are torn and whose shoulders and arms are naked. It's a direct quote from the Rif. You can even compare them one to another. So his clothes are like a belt beneath his armpits and downwards. Such a person is called a pocheach. As it is written, go and loose the sackcloth from off thy loins. We translate, go and loose the sackcloth from off thy loins. And it says, he did so walking naked and barefoot. And God said, like as my servant Yeshaya has walked naked and barefoot. And we translate, the Lord said, like as my servant Yeshaya has walked pocheach and yachif. This is all direct quote from the Rif. The Rosh will very often do this. He will excerpt directly from the Rif. This teaches that pocheach refers to one who wears a belt on his loins, but who leaves his shoulders and arms bare. The Yerushalmi writes, etc. It's all a direct quote from the Rif. And it's no wonder, because Tosfos rejected Rashi's reading of the Mishnah and seemed to endorse the reading of the Rif. And the Rosh is telling us, basically, that this endorsement extends to the entirety of the text of the Rif. Tosfos endorses the Rif as is, no modifications, no qualifications, no amendments, says the Rosh. Tosfos, I, as a representative of the Baal HaTosfos, stand fully in the camp of the Rif. Let's even attempt the Rambam for a second. So the next three sources are the Rambam, the third of the great triumvirate, and the Rambam, let's see how the Rambam paskins this Mishnah. The Rambam writes, one whose shoulders are revealed, he doesn't say ksifav arumot, right, but rather he says his shoulders are revealed. It's a little bit perhaps more of a lashon nikia, but maybe being revealed and being naked means two different things. I'm not sure. Even though he can recite the half Shema, he may not become the chazan, he can't be the shliach tzibur until he is atuf, until he's covered. I think that the next Magid Shir is here, so we'll continue with this Be'ezras Hashem on Monday.